everybody. How are you today? Happy Mother's Day. All the cinematic mothers, real world mothers, people who act like mothers and take care of a whole lot of people who aren't their children. Terrible introduction, but we are thrilled to be introducing our next guest, president and founder of firstshowing.net, Alex Billington, all the way from
Berlin.
Man, how's the weather in your world? How's things going?
Beautiful today, actually. It's really lovely spring day today. It's sunny and blue skies and warm and nice.
Thanks for joining the show, buddy. Thanks a lot for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me on, and thanks for chatting with me, and thanks for including me in the conversations.
Well, a long time ago, Alex was kind enough to let a lot of writers and podcasters flourish on his website, and I was one of the guests for a show called The Film Feed, which had a trio of really young and passionate film fans who have gone on to, I'd like to say, CrossFit, almost political careers, and a whole lot of concerts. I haven't really kept up with Clark and Will in the past. Have you talked to them in a while?
I haven't. I think they've moved on to other areas as well, like you said.
Well, great. Well, Alex, why don't we, since we're kind of cinema fans to our core, why don't we just open this up to you? Let's get to know you. What were some of the first movies you saw growing up? What cemented something in your body and said, this is what I need to be close to for the rest of my life?
Well, I think like most white American kids, which I admit I am, and I'm middle class upbringing. I was raised by my dad showing us VHS tapes of recorded on TV movies, and there was a lot of the typical Indiana Jones, Star Wars were the big ones that we think any geek of this era. And then I distinctly remember Mighty Ducks being like the definitive movie for me. It was like anytime, anywhere we watched it. I think there was another one around this era too. Land Before Time and this kind of like super nerdy, but like as a kid growing up, you're like, I love it. It's just the best kind of stuff. And my brother and I would also, I have an older brother, 3 years older than me. So my brother and I would always attempt to rent the craziest stuff we could get from the video stores. And I think like most white American kids who grew up in the 80s, we went to the video store all the time and would just rent something either between Blockbuster or Hollywood Video or one of the local ones. And we always had fun with crazy stuff. Like I remember this one specifically, Robot Jocks, where these giant robots fight. I also remember UHF, the Weird Al film, which is just ridiculous. Like stuff like that, where it was like, you know, I think this is kind of what's different about the current era is that back then there was almost this special, like you found it, you found these secret movies that you found in the back of the video store and there was one VHS left and you rented it and you put it on and you and your family were discovering this. And that was these exciting moments. And I think the other thing I'll mention, because I can never forget this, is that my dad every year at Christmas would buy us the Leonard Maltin movie guide. And it was this like huge, 4-inch thick book where he would like, the funniest thing is we would watch a movie and we'd be like, what did Maltin have to say? And we'd flip to it and he would be like, this movie sucked. And we're like, well, we just really enjoyed this movie, but Maltin has his say. And we always had to see what he had to say, no matter what it was. So I think like everyone, I was this kind of movie geek kid who I wasn't raised on, international cinema and foreign stuff. I was raised on the Hollywood titles. And I think Star Wars and Indiana Jones were like my foundational Hollywood movies that kind of progressed me into being, as I grew up, more and more a movie fan. So like every summer it was like, we're going to go to everything. We're going to see what we can see, like anything that Hollywood puts out, I'm usually interested in.
Well, I think that what is excellent about that is that I too also had some very very important movies on VHS, something that felt like they belonged to you in a sense, and even though something like, it was Predator, it was Top Gun, it was Volunteers, it was Back to School, Back to the Future, all these things that were on cable, but just there's almost a proprietary thing. Like when you have it on a VHS, you took the time to record it and you planned for it. And then it's like, it became yours. And even those, you remember the intros to it. It was like the HBO introduction was like, Arnold Schwarzenegger battles a high-tech jungle in Predator tonight at 8. Just like that preface to these things, just, you know, like that stuff sticks with you. But I also love the idea that in the 80s, it seemed like anything can and did go. And I just don't think that we get that level of balls out. Like, you know, like I said, UHF and RoboJocks. And you know, I was a big fan of Mannequin and The Wizard. And like, those movies weren't bizarre, but I just don't think they can make them today. Those are like really just chance movies. But
I don't know. I've always wondered now, looking back on it in retrospect, whether it was because they could throw the money at it and take the risk, or it was because they knew there would be an audience. Like, I think that's the interesting thing, is that nowadays, and maybe I'm being too critical, but some audiences, I feel like they just want the same thing, and they always want the same thing handed to them, and that's what Hollywood keeps making now. But now that I think about what was in the past, I'm like, people, it's not that people would take a risk and not necessarily see it. It was like, hey, you put Stallone in a movie and you're going to see it no matter how ridiculous it is. And I think that worked back then. And I think it didn't, like you're saying, it didn't matter what they did. They just wanted to make some crazy stuff in it. They just went loose on it, let loose on it, and made something that, whether or not it stands the test of time, I don't know. But for our era growing up, they were fun to watch anyway.
Well, you also bring up the whole going to the movie store. And even before Blockbuster, I remember going to a place called Family Vision Video, which was clearly a family little, you know, mom and pop shop. But just, you know, taking a little peek and going, should I be looking at Puppet Master, or what is, you know, what is Maniac Cop 4? Like all these things are like, and it's so amazing that the advertisement surrounding these movies, you know, when you watch the Drew Struzan documentary, half the times you look at the cover, you go like, that's not the movie that I'm watching. How, like, where's the fun in the artwork, and where's that that preface and advertisement? That it's, I love cinema just because you can go down all these little roads of pockets of interest. And you bring up Land Before Time, and I know that you are a big film score fan. So that was a great James Horner score. What were some of the scores that really spoke to you at a young level?
Ooh, 100% number one comes to mind is Dragonheart.
No way.
Yeah, I that was like the CD that was on constant rotation when I was a kid. And the other one was The Peacemaker, which was this, it was like one of the few R-rated movies I was allowed to see at the time. But I just remember something about that score that it was just like, I'm going to put it on and listen to it all the time. And those were the two that I just remember, like I could even visualize the moment of me like picking up the CD and, you know, putting it into my thing and playing it. And I think it was just like, I got addicted to Dragonheart specifically as just the constant rotation, which now that I think about it, is that a Hans Zimmer or is it a, cause Hans Zimmer did The Lion King too, which still blows my mind.
Yeah.
And I'm like, he's been working for 40 years in like his early stuff. You're like, I didn't even realize that was Hans Zimmer.
No, I mean like Driving Miss Daisy and Hard Rain and Black Rain. And just, yeah, these things that don't like, he's taken so many turns in his career, but like the one that really spoke to me as a kid was The Rock. And so I played that infinitely. And I feel like I kind of understood what music could do to film right around the time I was watching Back to the Future, because there were certain beats in the story, you know, like the famous scene where he's trying to catch the bolt of lightning and just like the timing of things. And I was like, there's something happening here that's making me feel more invested in the movie. And after that, it was John Williams' Hook and Jurassic Park and, you know, real seminal composers, but then also, you know, weird one-offs like Elliot Goldenthal, not like he's a one-off, but just ones that you don't associate, you know, Graham Revell, and just, you know, a lot of these composers I hold dear to my heart.
Yeah, that's, now that you mentioned, I'm looking up the Dragonheart soundtrack, and if I'm not mistaken, it's Randy Edelman, who it's like, I don't even know this composer, but it's, I think it's to me, it's still iconic. Like I could listen to it now and still enjoy it.
I think he did 6 days, seven nights with Ivan Reitman. And I think he also did, I know he did Shanghai Noon, which I have a soft spot in my heart. But but now let's jump to that. I think that's always kind of fun. It doesn't have to be a guilty pleasure, but what are some of the movies that either you love for some obscure reason, or you're the only person that you know who actually is a fan of it, or there are things that make, you know, like what's Alex Billington's sort of dirty laundry?
Well, my number one, again, instant off the top of my head is Hackers.
Okay.
I'm a computer geek, and Hackers for computer geeks, because I know all my friends were like this too. It's like, as dumb as it is, as entirely inaccurate as it is, it's the most glorious hacking movie ever made to us. You know, like, it fits the bill for what a hacker kid would do if he were to make a Hollywood movie about hacking. Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how terrible it is, it's just genius entertainment. And it's like, I can rewatch it even now as an adult, and I'm like, it's still great. And along the same line, although these aren't really guilty pleasures, but just things that define me, are sci-fi films. So The Fifth Element is one of my all-time favorites, and Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers was an important part of my upbringing because I had to beg my mom for months to let me go see it. Because not only was it R-rated, but there were a number of topless scenes in it, which was the thing that was like, she would let me go to action and violence, but not nudity, you know? And that was the one that was like, I was like so nerdy about it. I would make like little books of the bugs and images from the movie to be like, mom, take me, like, I have to see it. And this is actually a good question to ask for difference between then and now, is that how often is it that you have that much hype for a movie that you just have to see, and then it actually lives up to the hype and it's actually as good as it is, and something that still stands like through the test of time now to be great. Like, the VFX are still impressive today, which is kind of amazing. Same with Fifth Element. Mm-hmm. Like, how do these movies last that long? And beyond that, I've been known for the last, you know, two decades running the site for being a fan of movies that people hate. I mean, I wouldn't say Avatar is the best example of that, but these kind of movies where I'm just like, super sci-fi, weird stuff that for some reason the critics are like, this is trash. I'm like, I really enjoyed this. You know, like, that's the kind of stuff that I've, not recent sci-fi, but for the early 2000s and 2010s, I was always like, there's some sci-fi out there that I'm going to love and then people don't. I think there was this one, now that I forget the name, it was like an upside down world thing. That was this indie sci-fi, and I remember all the critics like hated it, and I watched it and I was like, this is really beautiful and interesting. I think it was like Kristen Dunst or something. It was something else that was like, this is the funny thing, is it's been completely forgotten in time, but I know.
But you still stand up for it, right?
Well, yeah, like I would even say Cloud Atlas is an interesting one. Cloud Atlas is one where I thought everyone was going to love it. Like, I ended my screen and was like, everyone's going to think this is a masterpiece like I do. And then everyone was like, this was really bad. And I understand why it's not loved, but I still think it's a phenomenal film. And I think it's just because I'm a Wachowskis fanboy too. Like, mm-hmm. I've always enjoyed anything they make. And I think they, except for Jupiter Ascending, but everything else in general, I'm like, okay, if the Wachowskis touch it, I love it. Like Speed Racer. Speed Racer has kind of grown in the film community, but mm-hmm. when it came out, everyone hated it. I had like an event and I brought all these people to the IMAX to see it, and none of them enjoyed it. And I was like, this is phenomenal. Why are you guys against it? And it's this kind of weird stuff that I'm always defending, more sci-fi than anything, because I'm a huge sci-fi guy.
Okay. Well, it's funny, you know, we all have, in my mind, watershed moments or jumping off points. And I remember Speed Racer was something where I didn't quite get it, because I, in my opinion, it stuck, you know, usually when you make an adaptation, you take some liberties, or like the best one, in my opinion, is Bryan Singer's X-Men. And, you know, the whole idea of them making it a little more grounded, they're all wearing black leather. And then even that line between Hugh Jackman and James Marsden, where he's like, what were you expecting? Yellow spandex? So it's like, there's things you need to do to make things work in the real world. That said, I have this feeling, if you stick too close to the source material and you stay too much of a fanboy, that can tend to lose people. So I kind of feel that Speed Racer might have been that. But I was having this discussion with Todd Gilchrist, and he was telling me, it's like, just think about it in, you know, like the cinematic aspects and storyboarding and comparisons. And that really made me appreciate more of, you know, what filmmakers do, because no matter what movie you see, good, bad, or indifferent, it's not for a lack of trying that it's bad. And they put so much work into it. So to dismiss it as like, meh, it is a little it's like undercutting to the creative team. So I always try to give people the benefit of the doubt. But yeah, where I'm going with that is Michael Giacchino's music in that was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And Todd's suggestion to me, we were talking about like avenues and niches and things to make your site really flourish. And that's kind of where I took a detour from film news to music journalism and music interviews. And that was a nice little shift for me. But And it's all because of these, you know, these great relationships that film fans have with each other in conversations that advance each other. So a little bit of a fanboy here. I've been reading your stuff for years, Alex. And so, you know, like I was actually introduced to your site from Vic Holtzman when he started Screen Rant. And so for years, I was kind of using FS as a, like my litmus test for what I should be doing. So I appreciate you being on the show, and also want to say, I like your passion for film, and Go See Talk has become what it is just because you were a good, how do you say it? Like a roadmap. So just want to get that out there.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've, this isn't the topic we're talking about, but one of the things that I find interesting is that I've gone through so much evolutions of the site. You know, there was a time where we didn't do any movie news, and there was a time where we did that. And then a lot of it has been, in the blogging era, kind of like a see what works, but also I think this is what people picked up on, is what we're passionate about. That was always our drive between me and all the other film blogs. We're like, we're going to do what we think is really driven by what we are excited about, what we're interested in. We would cover things this way, do things that way, because we're like, hey, this is exciting to us. And we were different than the trades and the other people because that's what drove us, is because it wasn't like, I mean, we all have to focus on traffic in some ways, but in general, we were like, we're going to cover it this way because this is what matters to us. We're going to like provoke the studios, because they were always hesitant about blogs, because we also thought we should be a part of it too. And all of it kind of worked out. And I've always kind of enjoyed that. Stay true to who you are and to your passions, and let those drive you in what you do, because that's going to be important, especially in the long term, to stay working and to stay excited about what you do in your job. Is you need to always maintain that passion. I always tell that to people, like, don't lose your passion. If it's cinema, don't lose that. It's going to be hard sometimes, but don't lose that passion.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you I remember you interviewed both Miyazaki and Takahata, and I thought that was a really cool opportunity, just to be like, I think geographically and at the time that sites like Slash Film and First Showing were, you know, kind of in the LA area. Can you talk about like how that might have actually helped you, you know, get a leg up over, you know, like I'm in Texas and I know people who blog out of Florida and New York. So being that close to the epicenter, you know, what opportunities did you have?
Well, I started the site in Colorado because that's where I grew up. And then I made the leap, and, you know, the cheesy, local newspaper literally had the, you know, blogger moves to LA, moves to Hollywood to do his thing. And so, of course, my first step was, okay, I gotta go to LA. I don't actually like LA. I had a really miserable time there, but I lived there for 4 years trying to see what it was like. And it was kind of what you're saying. It was like, I'm there to be next to the studios. I in my apartment, I had this like big collection of all the studio stickers when I would drive there and park on the lots. And a lot of it was also just learning to, the studios, I think, were really open to blogs at that time. Like, they'd learned the value of them. But at the same time, I think our passions came through. So the Miyazaki thing was interesting, because this was like right around the time when he had been refusing to come to the US, and Disney had convinced him to come for, I think it was Ponyo. And it was one of these, like, it was me and Steve from Collider, Steve Weintraub. And we were both like, we knew this was a once in a lifetime thing. We're like, he will never come to the US again, you know? And we just pushed and pushed and pushed. And I think this is, I would admit, if someone's listening to it about publicity and trying to understand the inner workings of it, is that we were always kind of relentless in dealing with the publicists. Like, we knew the marketing people, we knew the publicists, and we wouldn't let them just say no. We were like, we're gonna push, 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 and make sure we get this, because we are hardcore Miyazaki nerds and we need to interview him. And I think one of the things that made us different is that we always got so tired of reading interviews that were like stale, you know, magazine interviews that are just like, what's it like to be a filmmaker who makes films now? And you're like, come on, you know, ask real questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the other thing, is that we always thought, okay, we're going to, Steve especially, because Steve's an interview master, is that we thought we're going to go in and ask interesting questions. We're going to do more than just take the interview time. And we're going to challenge people on that. And we're going to do something interesting. And I always did that. One of my other really big gets was I kind of befriended Mark Strong.
Oh, nice.
Because Mark Strong was doing, I think he was in like Body of Lies at the time.
Oh, the Ridley Scott movie.
Yeah, he had like these small side roles. And every time I'd pop up, I'd be like, this guy's awesome. And he was not on the junket list. He was not participating. And I pushed the studio like over and over and over. Like, I want an interview with this guy that you're not even promoting. And he's cool. And I know I'm not the only one who knows that this kind of up and coming British actor in all these side roles of all these like Guy Ritchie films and stuff. And in addition to Ridley's film. And at the end of the day, they were like, okay, you got an interview. And I get this number and I call it, and it's like his personal number at home.
No way.
He's like, hi. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, oh, I'm just finishing dinner with my wife. And we're, I was like, and then I ended up talking with him. And that was the coolest thing, is that I think he also realized that people were a fan of him. And it kind of opened him up to this idea that he can participate in this publicity too. Because I think as an actor, he just thought he's an actor doing his gigs and the studio wasn't promoting him. And this was important to me because it was like an opportunity to promote someone that I thought was awesome and talented, and also was a one-off thing. Like, no one else had this interview. No one else had this chance to talk to him. And from that point forward, it was like, we exchanged the email and we kept in touch.
That's great.
Yeah. And those are the kind of things that have been key to me, especially in the early parts of my career, is like, don't forget to push back in a little bit. I think some people are afraid of that. They're afraid of the Hollywood system, which it is daunting, but at the same time, like, trust your instincts and push for what you really want. I was coaching someone like in the last year about saying, push for more one-on-ones, like get that one-on-one interview you really want. Like, it might not happen. You're probably not going to get Tom Cruise, but try, give it a shot, see what can happen.
Absolutely. And more to that point, I can actually speak to a little success on that, because whenever you do a press junket, and that's one of the sort of defeating things about how the pandemic and the post-pandemic world has been, that people don't, everything Zooms or everything is, there's so much, there's far less one-on-ones in person. And that used to be actually the highlight of my day, is going to the hotel and, commiserating with the other journalists and, the little time before you have 5 minutes with somebody. But over the years, it's gotten to the point where 5 became 10, 10 became 20. Now it's like, I'm not saying I get this for everybody, but, if I want to speak to Brian Tyler or Steve Jablonski, I can just, hey, you want to do an hour? Sure. And it's like, you get the time to get both the banal questions, but also the fun questions. And that's what I really did. Hate is the wrong word, but jealousy is probably the right one. When you would see NBC or Variety, and they would say, yeah, exactly like you said, the sort of, press junket questions. And it's like, you don't ask questions that have been answered in the press junket and waste their time, because, you're like, you look like you're new. So.
Well, I say this not to be egotistical, but one of my other iconic interviews was a Zack Snyder interview during, Man of Steel.
Okay.
And the reason this was iconic is at that point I had like not become friends with, but I'd been on a bunch of his sets, and his wife is his producer, Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
So she had kind of picked up on the fact that she was, both Zach and her were very big fans of the blogs. They like knew that these people were genuine fans. And so they had always kind of highlighted and made sure they were more participating in the publicity. And so I kind of followed him all these years, and I got to know him, and I got to know his personal publicist, and I knew all of these people. So by the time we got to this Man of Steel interview, it was basically like, people were like, it looked like, Alex, you were just talking to a friend, and Zach gave the most honest answers he's ever given. And people still say that now watching this interview, it's still on YouTube. And I think I was like, yeah, because I just wanted to do a genuine interview with someone who I respect. And here's the key, is he respects us in return. He knows that we're film fans and that we're doing our job, not just because it's paying us, but because we are nerdy about it, and because we care about what we're doing, and because we want to help promote these films that we love too. And if it, like the filmmakers, and I think a lot of composers too, a lot of writers, a lot of editors, a lot of VFX people, they understand this as well. They recognize that like they're film fans too, and they recognize that in you, and they kind of just want to like give you like pay back to you the fact that, hey, we're all here together, we're all participating in this. It's not a give and take kind of thing with like, oh, hey, I'm giving you this interview so that you can get traffic on your website. It's like, hey, I respect you equally. And I think that makes a huge difference in the end in terms of what you're doing with interviews and coverage and Hollywood in general. I think it's like the idea was always that people can smell that. They can pick up on it when they read or listen to what you're doing. They can see right through the BS and sense whether it's authentic or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk to me about moving. I mean, because what one of the great things about the coverage that your site has gotten, I mean, you've done the big Telluride, you've done Cannes. I mean, it's always a joy to see, or Sundance, to see that, you know, your site getting like the primo movies early in the year, and then the rest of us yeomen have to wait for it to come down and filter through. So like, can you talk about going to those film festivals and being the first to, you know, spread to the audience?
I would say this, I say this in retrospect because I've been, this has been 16 years now, so I've kind of established myself. But in early on, one of the things that defined me was that the trades and magazines and bigger outlets would always have the one up on us, always. You know, they would always go to screenings before us, they would always get interviews before us, they'd always get exclusives and premieres before us. And it really upset us by the film blocks. So one of the things I realized is that going to these things like festivals was always the biggest and easiest and clearest way to even the playing field. And to say, no one has an advantage now. So for example, Before Midnight, the Linklater third one in his trilogy. When we saw Before Midnight at Sundance, he really had truly never shown it to anyone yet. So everyone sitting there at that auditorium was there. And so to your question, one of the things that really pushed me was like, okay, I'm gonna try LA. And then I eventually moved to New York City. And I came up with every and any possible way to get things done. So when I lived in Colorado, before I moved to LA, I had a friend and I would sleep on his dirty mattress in his corner of his apartment who lived in LA just to get there and do the junkets. You know, I would, the only thing I would pay for was like a rental car and the airline ticket. Wow. And then everything else, I would just scrounge. And the first few years I went to Sundance, I would drive 8 hours across from Colorado to Utah. I would sleep on my brother's couch in Salt Lake City and just take any and every opportunity I could. For many of the festivals I've gone to, I've done like sleep sharing where it's like 8 of us in a tiny condo, you know? And we just, I know costs are so the biggest thing that gets in the way of everything. And I've always thought my whole life, like, what can I do to help people? One of the things I kept doing for Comic-Con was that I would rent the room or rooms, like 2 rooms. And I would be able to do this because I had business expense money at this point. And I would just invite like 6 people. And I know I shouldn't say this because Comic-Con will ban me, but I don't go right now. Is that I would get 6 people badges for first showing. And it was like, these people were just like friends of mine who were hardcore, you know, comic book movie nerds. And I was like, I just want to bring them there and remove that like challenge of the cost of getting there and do it. And I think one of the big things that you're probably touching upon here is that New York and LA are like the centers of entertainment for America. And America is such a huge country that it's not even, you know, there's no way you cannot be in these places, but there's also no way you can get to these places without spending a lot of money. You can't just like drive up there and come back unless you live in California or New York. And I've always jumped into it, just trying it, realizing that like these cities aren't my place unless I feel like I can really make a lot of money or I feel comfortable there. And at the same time, that doesn't mean that that should be limiting for what we can cover. Now, of course, the studios are based in LA, and of course they have offices in New York City, but that doesn't mean you can't, you know, host junkets elsewhere, do them virtually, have screenings all over the country, do this and that. And I think there used to be a time when that was more possible. When I lived in Colorado, I would drive to Denver all the time, which was an hour drive for me. And it was like the only way to see these movies. Yet we had a month early. I saw Children of Men a month before it came out. And I was like a nobody website. And it was still, it was like, this is the thing that I think is truly important now, is to make sure that access is still available to everyone and to make sure that it's not only New York and LA, because no one can really afford that if you're working on your own. You can't just go there. I don't know. It's an interesting, I'm more curious to hear from you how you do it and what you hear from people nowadays, and what is the landscape changing? Are they being more willing to recognize that it's not New York and LA people only?
Unfortunately, no. You know, the scariest thing about this is, I'd like to say that we're old timers. You know, we've both been doing this for more than a decade. And what I found going in is that it was so easy to start a blog, but then the passion filtered and faltered to the point where somebody would pop up and then fall off the radar. So I could see that studios were very hesitant to put any money into, or time into something that may not be there, especially when they don't have the numbers like newspapers and radio and things like that. And we always get sort of shunned. And then by not being in those two hot pockets, we similarly get shunned because they just don't think that Texas is a market. They don't think that, you know, Houston's a market. Well, yeah, I mean, we've got our population is going to double by 2050. So there's a lot of people here. It actually would behoove them to do more things outside of those two coasts. But to this day, it's still still not a big thing on their radar. But one of the great things is you have little film festivals like Fantastic Fest or South by Southwest, which I think is showing the studios that there's opportunities mid-country to just, you know, get away from, you know, get off their ivory tower, so to speak. But the I think the scariest thing is that now that the barrier to entry is almost nothing, you can launch a website at any time, you can host, you know, there used to be a creator limit on YouTube video uploads, which, you know, prohibited you from doing more than like 15 minutes. So all these opportunities to put content out there, I think they're seeing the value in that. But the thing is, how that relates to ticket sales, that's never going to be figure that out. So they still lean on radio and print. But I guess to like round this full circle, with so many people getting in the game, you know, Mark Strong or Robert Downey Jr., they've only got so much time. So now you've got a pie, whether it was in New York or LA or in Texas. Now you've got a pie that's cut into 27 pieces. Now it's 36, now it's 45. And so the opportunities are less and less and less and less. So whereas you might get 8 minutes at one point, now you're down to 4. And it just, you know, they're trying to make everybody happy, but it's just, there's only so many sort of people that can sit high on the pyramid in the journalism game. And I just don't know how that's gonna get fixed.
One of the things that I've worked on in the last 10 years was really questioning whether I really want or need interviews, whatever it may be. Like there was a time where I was like, yeah, I really want to interview this. And then I would ask myself, like, do I really want to interview this actor just to get a screening invite? And I think what I've learned also from watching the media landscape for so many years is that there are people who do it really, really well. And when they do it really well, like especially like interviewing composers in the music world, like you, there are certain people where I'm like, oh, look, I have no idea what to talk to these people about. And I feel really bad. And I interviewed Alexandre Desplat at one point, and I think to myself, I don't think I did a good interview. And I think to myself, like, I would not only like to give it a second chance if I had to, but at the same time, if I really sit down and ask myself, I'm like, that's the kind of thing where I'd rather say, hey, this should go to someone who really truly knows what they're talking about and deserves that interview rather than me. Or to be a little bit critical, I always, you know, we keep talking about these like major junket interviews that get boring answers. I always thought to myself, like, why does this outlet need this? Why can't that interview time go to someone who actually genuinely is interested? I think that's also what you were saying before about Miyazaki and Takahata is like, these people, I fought for these interviews because I was like, I know I'm going to ask and I'm going to take advantage of this time I have with them and deliver something that I know is going to be, to the best of my ability, a once in a lifetime interview versus it's the next thing to promote thing. And I've kind of given up on interviews in the last few years because I just don't, on one hand, I'm like, I could rather other people take the time. On the other hand, I'm like, I just don't feel like I gain as much as I used to from them. And I then question what can I provide and what do I want to provide to the film community and to the film world in my position, which is like, I want to see movies and talk about them and add my perspective, but what specifically does that mean and how can I do that now? And I think to your point as well, there's so many different ways to participate now. I think that's one of the most interesting things to me is it's not simply writing a film blog, it's videos and podcasts, and I mean, you could even say TikTok and Letterboxd and different ways beyond Twitter and social media. And how there's more to me going on now than just a guy sits in front of a laptop, writes his thing, and publishes it to here, and that's it, you know.
Absolutely, and you know, a lot of it comes down to this is personally speaking, time and interest. So, a lot of what you were saying before about, you know, sometimes I'll get a pitch too, and I'll say, you know, this guy is a British legend and he's promoting a book, but someone who values his career needs to be more suited towards speaking. I don't want to waste this guy's time, so to speak. Yeah. But the other thing too is that I think that when Will Smith does a movie, when, you know, Jennifer Lawrence does a movie, a lot like you said, when somebody that who has name recognition in the entertainment community, I mean, they could be selling paper clips, and a good portion of the country is going to go, I think I'm going to go see that. They don't need to go on a morning talk show to promote it. It should, you know, there should be opportunities out there. I think that's a really valid statement too. It is though weird though, because there are so many things that are vying for our attention, whether it's our phones or whether it's TV or something like that. And I kind of feel that the advertisement game is kind of like, if you're not front of mind, then those are lost ticket sales. And I kind of feel that, you know, I talked to a friend of mine who took advertisement in school, and I said, well, haven't you drunk enough Bud Light in your life that you know that that's your beer of choice? And she's like, well, it's funny you mentioned that, but if they don't promote it, people are going to forget about it, and that's going to affect their sales. And I was like, no way. It's like Bud Light, it's Nike, you know? I don't know how you, you know, get past that, but I would imagine that film and entertainment has got to be that same same way of going about it.
Especially nowadays, I've noticed that because I used to track marketing so closely for so many years, that it used to be they would start a marketing campaign 6 months early. Now they don't even begin mentioning it until 1 month. And it's like 1 month before release, they'll finally release a trailer and a poster. And then the last week they'll do a push, because they know that we're so distracted and there's so much going on that if you promote it 6 months out, no one's going to remember it. Like you said, like, it's a weird thing. I don't think it's good, but I also understand that these marketing people are saying, we're doing whatever we possibly can to get people to go see this and buy the ticket and get out there. One of the things that has always driven me, and as you mentioned at the beginning, my tagline of connecting Hollywood with this audience was trying to understand, and there's no way to really track this in data, but trying to understand the difference between being interested in a movie and actually buying a ticket and going to see a movie. And there's a huge leap between what the studios see as, oh, they're interested in it, they know what it is, and actually buying a ticket. Marvel's in its own boat. But for many years, that was one of the things that I had to challenge with, because I thought, I can do a good job getting people excited about it. Like Super 8 is a great example. Super 8 was a, you know, completely original concept. And while it was J.J. Abrams, he wasn't the biggest thing ever at the time. And it was a hard sell. And so I know that people were interested in it. There was this huge buzz about it. But I remember the big thing I was thinking when they were doing the last few weeks of promotion is like, okay, but how do I actually get people to go see this movie? Aside from telling them it's good, what is going to be the hook? And, you know, there's also this question of, well, you can't really give away the thing that you think that they would want to go see in it, but you also like want to help, you know, push them and lead them to that point. And it's, I think to me, that's the greatest marketing challenge of our current day and age, is that connection between interest and actually purchasing a ticket and what makes you sit down and watch it. Because you can't forget, and I say this importantly in the film community, is that people who've been given free screeners for the last 16 years, I have to realize there's a difference between that and actually my value of what I'm buying a ticket to go see. And then I have to, there is that question of, I'm going to spend my money, it better be worth that money, which is different than us thinking, hey, I get a free movie and I get to tell you it sucks. Well, that's different than buying a ticket to go see it, which I personally do it every so often this year, just to go have that experience of like, I spent my money and now I get to connect that between, it was that, you know, 10 euro I spent really worthwhile to see this, and was the movie worthwhile? I think it like makes your brain think a little bit more about the movie experience.
Oh, 100%, 100%. Because I find myself within maybe the first 10, 15, 25 minutes just going, okay, whether I paid for this or not, I think to myself, would I want to see this again? Like, am I enjoying it from the get-go? Yeah. And one of the things that I've, a turn that I've taken personally is, a long time ago when somebody was talking to me about pros and pronouns and how I should structure my reviews, he says, don't put yourself in it. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, don't put, I like this, or I don't think this worked. Because unless you're Roger Ebert, no one's going to care about you. And he wasn't being crass, but what he's saying is that, you know, everyone's got opinions, just like everyone's got eyeballs. The thing is, like, you need to say what, you know, like, subjectively and objectively, like what's working, what's not, but don't put yourself in it. So all that said, I was thinking to myself, you know, taking that step further, nobody cares what I think. You know who really is the, who needs to say what they think? The people who made the stuff that we love. And that's why I've really taken a turn to not doing reviews. I want to talk to people who made the decisions that affect what we see on screen And ergo, if, you know, turns out, you know, depends on what we like and what we don't like about it. So all that said, I was like, I just don't think there's a point in criticism, because that's the wrong way to go about appreciating the art. Let's find out about how it was made. Did like a complete 180 for me.
This has always been my thing. I also remind people who get in the industry, I'm like, we see them as celebrities, but at the end of the day, they're just regular people. And a lot of the people who work in the film industry are film nerds like you and me. And that, like, I've made friends with people who are still up and coming, but I've also made friends with a lot of filmmakers and a lot of celebrities, because we just see each other as the same thing. We're like, oh, what did you see? What did you think of this? What did you, you know? And at the end of the day, that's when I like to sit down and do exactly what you say, which is like, ask them, what do you want to say? What do you want people to pick up on? What do you want them to know about your work? And how do you want them to like understand it? I think in the composing world, I think it's really interesting, because I don't think a lot of people understand how it works. And I also don't think a lot of people, every composer is different. I also think there's a difference between how someone like Clint Mansell composes versus how someone like John Williams composes versus how Michael Giacchino composes, and how they then bring that composition to the orchestras and create their music and what they do. And it's one of those things where all my music nerd friends are like, that's the only thing they care about is how people do it. But then you go back to the fans, and I think they care about how it sounds, which is, I think, one of my biggest interesting things is how to connect these, how to make people see like, oh, wow, this is how they made that. This is what they did. This is beautiful. I think one of the cool stories to me was the, now I forget his name, the composer for the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh, Daniel.
Pemberton or something like
that. Yeah, yeah.
And the way he explained that he would like live DJ mix to, you know, the thing and to the projection of what the movie. And I was like, that's so cool. Like you of course, when you're watching it, you're kind of so immersed in it, you're not really thinking about it. Then you're like starting to notice scratches that go along with edits. And you're like, okay, something's going on here. And then when you put these all together with the interview, you're like, this is awesome. Like, this guy is talented, but he's also incredibly passionate about making his music that fits with the movie and represents the experience of what you're watching and how you're getting into the story. And it's just like, it took it to a whole other level to me. And I just enjoyed learning so much about his process more than someone being like, I sat in a dark room and read the script and all this. And I think Hans Zimmer is also a fascinating example of, he'll be like, he said in interviews where he's like, either Nolan or someone major like that will give him the script and he'll write pieces, send it to the director, and the director will listen to this before they've even shot anything. And then that piece will influence Nolan while he's filming on set. And I'm like, again, I'm like, I had no idea this happens. And that's cool. That's so cool. This is the part of the process of filmmaking that excites me, not just watching it, but all of that whole how people interact and how this influences that and how it grows and evolves into something. It's cool. It's so cool.
Well, talk to me about what's happening now in your side of the world. You said you live in Berlin, talked about spending euros. What made you make the shift? How is it living there? And how is the cinematic culture in the EU?
Amazing. Well, it's not surprising. I would say a lot of the world loves cinema. That's one of the things that if we remove politics, we remove everything in the world, one of the things that actually does connect the world is movies. And has always done that. I moved to Berlin about 5 years ago because I was living in New York City and I just couldn't afford to live in New York City anymore. honest truth. And I love New York City. I was just like, I just can't do it anymore. I gotta make the leap somewhere. And I kind of just felt like this draw to Berlin. It's a very New York-y city. It's very international. It has great public transportation. It has this artist vibe here that New York has kind of lost. And it was just this like pull of, okay, I'm gonna make the leap. I literally just put 5 bags on a plane and flew over here and found an apartment and just kind of went with it. And the good thing is that the cinema culture here is just as strong as ever. I go to all the European film festivals now between Venice and Cannes, and I used to go to more in the Czech Republic and in the Netherlands. And I don't go to the London one though. I don't like the London Film Festival.
More on that later.
And the best part is that there is an incredible amount of cinemas here in Berlin. And I've been able to figure out, to the best of my abilities, the screening system. So I can still go to studio screenings here. Most of them, they do end up showing in English. And the biggest issue is that they show really, really late. Like it's usually a day or two before they open. But generally the culture here is strong because you can't forget that every country is also like really proud of its cinema. You know, like Germany's all like, look, we had Metropolis and all these early things and, you know, Fritz Lang and all this stuff. And then you're like, okay. And then now their modern cinema, like the movies they make, their Hollywood version of movies are terrible. But they have indie cinema and people here still love movies. So almost every time I go to the cinema here, it's at least half or if not completely full. The audiences are into it. They have, one of my favorite things about Berlin is they have a great selection of outdoor cinemas, which are like during the summer season, they have these huge kind of tiered seating in the middle of a park. And they'll just show like last year's best movies and there's like five or six of them. So you can always go have a great time in the summer. And it's just, I've really enjoyed being here and I've found that if I really think about it and I'm really honest with it, I'm like, the internet is the most amazing thing because without the internet, I would not be able to do this. And the internet is the key to me being able to live here and still participate and be a part of the American film community while also being a part of the European film community and hearing them and listening to that and also participating here and listening to what people have to say here and realizing that we can still all be interconnected no matter where we are. You know, like we're talking now because we don't have to sit together in a room. I can be thousands of miles away and we can still have this podcast and it's great. And yeah. What more questions do you have? What can I answer about Berlin?
Well, you're now closer to Mark Strong. So do you guys get coffee regularly?
No. we haven't been in touch in years because he got like super famous.
Yeah.
I think the last time he was not known was Green Lantern. And then I think Green Lantern, as much as people hated it, it kicked him into the high time. And then he did Kick-Ass. And then he's been in all these kind of like, now he's
Shazam,
in his own world.
Sherlock Holmes,
which is great for him because he's one of these like genuinely loves acting kind of actors who just wants to do more work. Not, you know, he doesn't even care about publicity. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad he's just kind of like has the freedom to just take and do every role. I'm more friends with the film writers here in Berlin now than actors and directors.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, I think my Mark Strong was my man crush for a number of years just because I loved it. Every time he popped up on screen, I think my favorite of his is Rock and Rolla. That was it's a bit of a divisive movie, not Richie's best, but still there's a lot of charm and character that he brings to it. But
exactly.
Well, talk to us about the journalism community over there. Is it, you said it, the cinematic community is strong. Mm-hmm. What are the opportunities for you guys to get together? And how has that changed in the post-pandemic world?
Well, yeah, of course, festivals were the big thing. And of course, they also stopped screenings for 2 years. So those were like, I would see everyone at the screenings and I would see everyone at film festivals. And then I've just like, over the years, I've become friends with a lot of them. And we're just, you know, we just hang out and, you know, get dinners every so often and have beer every so often. And I think the journalism world is different because the first thing that they told me when I moved to Germany is they would be like, you make money with first showing? Because they would say to me, they're like, no one makes money with a blog in Germany. And I was like, okay, that kind of sucks, but I get it. There's only, you know, so many millions of Germans and there's not enough of them to read a blog enough to make it as their full-time thing. So I've met a lot of people who are like, do it on their own time. You know, they have a full-time job and they still do it, which is now a lot of what America is too.
Mm-hmm.
And the newspaper journalism world is stronger here in Europe still. I don't know how or why, but it is. And so a lot of the main critics here are like these kind of journalists. And then there's also like one or two major film websites that run in Germany. There's like Kino Zeit, which is just like the main, it's like the Fandango of Germany.
Okay.
And then there's one that I forget the name of it. That they had a big U.S. website. They had like a .com version of it. And their headquarters is here in Berlin. But I forget the name of it.
We will edit it and put that back in.
Well, I'll say at the end of the podcast, I'll be like, oh, that was it. So I've also enjoyed this mix of different film journalists when I go to festivals here, because it's like, it's not just German film journalists. I've met everyone from the whole world.
Nice.
You know, there's this guy from Slovenia who is like this, you know, diehard film guy. And he goes to every festival. He's got this giant beard. I love seeing him every single time. He like, we talk on Facebook. I've discovered there's huge film communities in Russia. There's huge film communities in Japan. Like, not that you wouldn't expect that, but just, you know, once you start to realize that, you're like, oh, right. It's, again, what I said before about the film connects us all. And that's the kind of magic of it, is that you can go and sit with these people. I used to be invited to these film festivals in Poland. And they take place in this city, this like a university city called, this is my Polish going to get in trouble here, Wrocław is the, I think, correct way to pronounce it. And it's this university city near Krakow in the south. And I would go there and I was like the only American dude with 300 other Polish like university kids sitting here watching film festival movies. And I was like, this is cool. I love it. I just love that, like, it, you know, I'm here with all these other Polish people who then you get out of the cinema and like all they want to do is talk to you about movies. It's just like, yes. And I'm like, I would have thought, I mean, again, it's not surprising, but as a person going out and experiencing the world, it's exciting to just be like, wow, okay, I didn't really think of how beautiful film is and how much it attracts all these people and how I can connect with some random guy I had never met before. And sorry, to go back to your question, in terms of journalism, I think they're having difficulties here too with maintaining it, and it's not easy, but at the same time, it's still a strong community in the EU to maintain journalism, and it's still important to you, for sure. Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people just want to gauge their expectations against somebody else's. They want to, you know, measure their expectations based on someone else's opinion. So if some mom in Topeka is like, I saw a screening of Gun, it's terrible, but see it anyway. It's like, you know, whatever the opinion is, I think people just want to like have a connection. And so I think that, you know, that takes it a step further to going to see a movie and, you know, going to an art festival or just something like that. So I think that there's something to be said about the sharing, even to the point where, you know, I literally hate these reaction videos. I don't know. That's how they get invested in things. So I can't take that away from them. I do crazy, stupid things all the time. But but I think that level of journalism, just getting the awareness out there, is really what people seek. It's just the, how does that equate to anything? Because I know that I've been in plenty of conversations with publicists who say, well, now we're giving more opportunities to YouTube bloggers because they have more hits than you do. And it's strictly a numbers game. And it's like, well, I'm not saying I ask better questions than they do, but like, let's put our cards on the table. Who can actually do a better job of connecting with the talent, making them feel welcome, and not asking press junket questions? But then they look at it like, well, they've got 17,000 subscribers, which, you know, you can't hold a candle to that or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, and this is something I want to ask you in a second. Doesn't mean every one of those clicks and likes. I mean, a lot like people in the art community, I follow a lot of artists on Twitter and they'll get likes and retweets, but that doesn't mean that people buy their posters or their artwork. So it's like, what's really doing the most good here for the art? Kind of defeating. But the question I had for you, so can we go back to probably the biggest marketing blitz I think I've ever seen by thanks to the internet was the Tron Legacy advertising campaign. Yeah. Now, that was on your site. You've been to D23 and Pixar a bunch, but like, what was it like in that? And I have never seen anything that big before.
This was awesome because I can spill the beans now that it's so many years removed, is that there's a company in LA, or at least they used to be in LA, called 42 Entertainment. And 42 Entertainment was behind The Dark Knight and the Tron Legacy campaign. And they were, they're also, one of the guys who runs 42 Entertainment is friends with Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails.
Oh, cool.
So they ran the Nine Inch Nails, if you heard about them, same kind of like big crazy viral things they did. So they had this experience in it, and what 42 Entertainment does really well is build the what you would say is the experience of it. And I will say this now, although I swear he's going to call me tomorrow and be like, why did you do this? But he would tip us off. And he would do it in a way where he knew that the studios would never do this because studios are very secretive and whatever. But he wanted to make sure that people picked up on it. And so he would come to people like me who understood it. It's like, I know what's going on. I know the campaign. I know how it works too, which is like, it starts, there's a clue. You have to follow it. You have to do this and that. And it's going to grow into something bigger. And there's going to be more and more and more. And like, for example, at Comic-Con, when they were doing this big Tron thing where you had to like run around the city and collect stuff, there was also this issue of if someone didn't get a clue, like if there was, you reached a point where something was wrong, he's like, well, you guys should go look at this thing. And all of this was exciting because I felt like he got it almost better than the studios. Like he's also this kind of geeky guy who, his name is Alex, I can tell you that much. It's like, 'cause the same name as me. And he also knew how the geek community works. And what I felt like that they really did and they really understood, especially about Tron Legacy, is that there is this depth to the film community and the people who love this movie that goes beyond just, it's a movie. It goes into, I wish I lived in the Tron world. And that's why when they were like, we're gonna build Flynn's Arcade in San Diego for Comic-Con, I was like, this is genius. But then you have to add this whole other layer of how you get in there. And then what they did with that too, I was like, these guys are incredible. And I also think it was in this era of Hollywood where they weren't afraid of spending money on marketing, which they now are. So the other thing I will dangerously say is that the reason they left Hollywood is that Hollywood didn't like the amount of money they had to spend with 42 Entertainment. And that I thought it was worthwhile. Tron and Dark Knight, although Tron wasn't the biggest hit, in terms of what you're saying, the fact that you remember the Tron Legacy marketing so many years later is a testament to its power. Whether or not people went to see the movie, different question. But that was just this, just, I'm glad they threw money at it, because I think it was like, yes, there's a risk that it won't open as big as they want, but believing in it connects with fans. And what I've gotten really tired of in the last few years was watching, like Disney sometimes does this, say, well, we know everyone's going to see the Marvel movies, so we're not going to interact with the fans anymore. And I'm like, you have, like, I said this before, Marvel's a whole other boat, but you can't forget that they want to be a part of it. Like, they want to be able to be literally involved, touching the things, you know, they don't want to just be on the sides. And this is what was so incredible to me about the Tron and the Dark Knight marketing campaigns, was that you could be there. You would get these cool collectible things. You would end up with the coin. Like, I still have the Flynn's Arcade coins from Tron Legacy.
Nice.
Because I was very like, nice. They're never going to make these again. You know, yeah. This is some special thing they had. And it was just these moments where I think lost in a time where I dream of them doing that again. I don't think they ever will. I mean, maybe it has to be the right movie, but that's the kind of marketing that really, I think, was also like perfect for me, because I was as much of a, I'm going to go do this, you know, participate in this as much as anyone else. I'm not just going to be a journalist because I need to document what I'm doing, but I'm like as excited as anyone, like, where do we go next, where do we get it, how do we get in? And you know, so I think that was, the 42 guys understood this. They were like, you're as much of a participant as anyone, and you're a journalist, and we want you to be able to cover it, but we also want you to be able to be playing it authentically and feeling that experience. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes back to the core of what they do, which is the experience of marketing is more important in the long run than the look of it, you know, than the, what does your poster look like? Okay, but is there an experience aspect to your marketing? That's where it can go, it can transcend just the look and the billboards and what you put out there.
And I still have my NCon badge, because I thought that, you know, the fact that they opened it up to literally the world by virtue of the internet, even people who weren't in LA, which it was like, every time I would see you or Peter or anybody from Screen Rant posts, I was like, I want to be there, but I'm here in Texas. But, you know, like, I got to get a old fashioned telegram from the promos from Cowboys and Aliens, and I got my MCOM badge, and just like, you know, being part of it, that's exactly what we as fans want to do. Like, so let's throw it out to a slightly bigger picture, Alex. So you said you wish you could live in Tron Legacy, but is there other movies that you're like, I want the ZF1 from, you know, The Fifth Element? Is there other worlds that I wish I could just, you know, spend a day in or a year?
Yeah, aside from Star Wars, which has always been you know, growing up as a Star Wars geek, I was always like, I just want to have a real lightsaber and walk around on Coruscant or something. I don't know if I want to go to a Tatooine, but you know, a nicer planet.
Mm-hmm. And then,
yeah. Oh, I even thought as a kid, I was like, I would love to visit Hoth. And then I was like, wait, there's nothing there. It's just like a snow planet. And then of course the other one, because I mentioned it earlier, it's true, is the Fifth Element. Like there's something about that Fifth Element world with like these stacked buildings. And I was like, I want to ride in his taxi. Like there's just something about it where I just thought, I love that Fifth Element world. It feels so believable. Luc Besson made it so real in a way that few films ever have. And I was like, I want to step into that world and be a part of that. I literally bought a prop gun at one point where it was like, it's a replica, but it had LEDs and everything. So it like switches on futuristic style and works like this. And I was like, I think later on, I was like, why did I buy this? But for a brief moment, I was like, I know why I'm buying this. Like you're saying, like, I want to be in that world and I want it. And the other one the other prop item that I remember that was my favorite prop item is a District 9 replica gun. One of the rail guns. It's full size.
Yeah, huge.
It was like, it would never fit anywhere. It was like, we always had to like build a thing to hang it on the wall because it would just never fit anywhere. And then whenever I would move, it was like this giant box. Like, what am I doing with this? Uh-huh. But hey, that's the film geek world, is you're like, I want these random things from movies, because it's exactly the question you ask. Like, I want to be in there. I want to be participating.
And to go back to what you said about the visuals of Fifth Element holding up, I just, every time Leelu jumps off of the building and it's, you know, it's her stunt double, and then they layer it just so much that her stunt double becomes digital as she goes further down. And even at the very end of the movie, right, when, you know, Corbin and Leelu save the day, and it's just a city street, but it looks like those stacked buildings. I'm like, how? Yeah. Why do we, you know, almost 20 years ago, we can't, you know, how does digital effects not keep up with that? But
excellent.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mr. First Showing, I see it's getting dark there. I don't want to keep you from calling your mom on Mother's Day. But before we leave, if you could just tell us kind of where we can find you, and also maybe just a slight detour into, you do some photography. I like some of your work. What got you interested in that?
No, I've been a photographer as far as I can remember. Like, my mom had some cheap plastic camera as a kid that I used, that she gave me. And I went to college for a couple of years in like 2004, I think one of the things I did was, you know, you're in college, you're experimenting. So I was like, I'm going to buy a DSLR and just try shooting with it. And that was great, because I was like, I did everything. I shot my friends, I did portraits, I did, you know, pictures of grass, like whatever I could do. And then I just sort of realized over the years, like, I just love photography. And I think the more I traveled, that was what really attracted me to it, was just like learning to, whatever my eyes see and whatever I like, I want to capture that in my way into my photos and sort of present that. And while I've tried to make money, I have made like 200 euro maximum. You know, I sold one postcard once. Which is, yeah, it's like sort of success, but not really. No, but yeah. So if you like my photography, I'm on Instagram at A Billington, just A and then my last name Billington. That's where all of my latest shots go. So yeah, and then as always, I'm on firstshowing.net. I'm on Letterboxd at First Showing. I'm on Twitter at First Showing. I don't want to recommend Facebook, but Facebook is there. I'm not on TikTok, and I'm not on Discord, but maybe one day I will be. We'll see.
Well, Alex, this has been a lot of fun. I'm glad we got to catch up. Finally, I feel like it's been forever. So
yeah, of course.
Everyone, please enjoy the rest of your weekend. I am Mark with the Go See Talk podcast experience, and we will catch you next time.